Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Brian Brushwood.
Ahoy.
Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
So, man, we anything to talk about. No, you know, self-starters launching anything. No big hits, big wins. No number one all over all media at all. Nothing like that at all. So I'm going to talk about the future of Fusion.
Can I confess that I'm embarrassed to admit that I took the longest of the three of us to figure out what you were teeing up? I was like, wait, was there something super obvious to talk about that? Because normally, and then I realized where this was headed.
Yes, Brian. So for those of you that live under a rock, under the sea, on another planet, in a galaxy far, far, far away, Mr. Justin Robert Young and Mr. Brian Brushwood it is.
Yes, Brushwood.
Along with, who's the real talent on the album?
Oh, Stephen freaking Cogswell.
Yeah, they put out a little album, the little gang put on a show. And Hokey Smokes, number one on iTunes, number one on Amazon, number one in music on Amazon. And I got to call Brian up and I got to do that. We got to do the little play, the whole like, hey, Brian, what's going on?
Oh, that was my favorite part. And so I just tweeted something and it was pretty late in the evening. I don't want to say it was like 2 a.m. or something, but it was late enough that you could tell it was only because I had tweeted that you felt permission to call in the middle of the night and the phone rings. And you didn't even say what, like you knew that I would know. And it's like, are you ready? You want me to start first or do you want to go? And then I was knowing exactly what you were setting up. I was like, I'll go first. hey, you know, I have the, number one album on Amazon.
I go, what category?
albums. The category is albums on Amazon. Like,
what category? Number one in what category of albums, Brian?
The category of albums, like of all the albums. that
may refer to a conversation I may or may not have had with somebody at one point about books when I hit number one for all books. And I had this. Because, you know, it's easy. You can game certain categories. Like, I'm going to do, you know, Latin pottery, you know, whatever, and be number one there. Like, I got the number one on Amazon. And, well, in a small category that there had been no new books in 3 months. But, and so I had that when I hit number one with Naturalist. You know, I was telling somebody who was one of these. I go, oh, yeah, number one book right now. They go, what category?
although, would it books. Have been more impressive to maybe say fiction? In all of fiction, like, because it's so hard to wrap your mind around all books. Whereas, like, number one fiction, I could grok that.
Oh, dunk on the Bible. It's all books.
But anyhow, Bible.
Now the way these things work is that if you move a lot of things in a short period of time, you can be on top of there. And you know, Brian and Justin are still moving, which is the fantastic part of the story. It's not like, you know, for an hour they got to the top of it. Several days at the top of the charts, and we're a week later, and they're an Amazon choice. They're the number one spoken word.
Yeah.
I believe on Amazon and iTunes. I haven't tracked that, but it's a wonderful success, and it shows you that it's your Amazon choice right now.
Dude, it was a real blast. I don't even know where to begin if we're giving advice. If somebody's listening to this podcast, they're like, oh, well, I want that too. What's the secret?
Well, that's a great – yeah, I have a book coming out on February 5th. Guys, I want that too.
Well, the key is get a time machine and start 10 years ago.
Okay.
By
the way, we are still the number two comedy album on iTunes.
Oh, that's great. So a week after launch.
So, you know, on one hand, I think the biggest thing is just having an audience that A, is interested in you and interested in the work, which that is the goal of everything, right? So that is, imagine that to be the concrete that you buy, that you build your store with. It is just something that, you know, look, it can be aided by you getting on a platform, but ultimately it is about the work. If you keep putting in the work and people keep liking it, then they will keep coming back, except for the one guy who left a 1-star review.
I deeply regret even informing you that was a thing.
No, it's fine. I'll let go of it immediately. That being said, I think what we've done a good job with, and now what's interesting is that for Night Attack, it's almost the show is almost as much about how high we can get the thing up close to the bell at the fair as it is the work itself. You know, I think part of the success of All's Well was in part because, look, we did something with Stephen Cogswell, who's an amazing musician who has, without pay and without desire for credit, just made us a song based on clips from the previous show, and he's done so for 3 years. And so, like, there was an element of let's showcase this, let's get this out there, let's make sure that a lot of other people get to listen to it, and also that fans of the show get to just have on their phone in a way that's a lot easier than searching the internet and playing it off a web browser.
And I think, like, in that regard, I think that's something that we didn't really think through, is what a gift we're giving to curate a 45-minute experience as you journey through all these, because it does matter to have it in a discrete package that it's like, now we're here, now we're moving on to this other thing. Whereas, you know, like, technically, it's all out there. It's all been out there as a series of singles that are available on, you know, on the website. But I don't know. Somehow, it matters to have it all as one package.
But then the other thing was just again this like, hey, we did it before, we can do it again. Let's see how what happens when everybody buys this thing at the same time. Although, this was by far, I think, the least organized we've ever done that. We have in the past said, like, all right, everybody at 5 p.m. Eastern time, that's when you buy the album. The difference here was, you know, I tweeted about it when it first went on sale on at midnight East Coast on Monday night. And then I woke up the next day and we were already doing about as good as we've ever done for a previous album's release. And so we were just like, okay, well, now is the time that you go. So everybody go now. And it just continued to climb and climb and climb.
So, Justin, you had talked about one of the most interesting aspects of doing the Contender was that it allowed you guys to pull back the kimono and tell everyone exactly the numbers and all that stuff in that Medium post. And you were suggesting that we have the opportunity to do the same thing again on this story.
Well, you know, you think about what we have as an advantage and what we have as a disadvantage. And it's like, what we did this without a label, a PR team, or any assistance within any of the platforms that we were selling it on, be it Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, or Apple Music and Spotify, the two biggest streaming services. Apparently, it's like CD Baby will offer like clips and tracks that, you know, up for to pitch to some of these places to try and you know, see if they want to promote it, but we got none of that. So what advantages do we have? Well, we don't care if we tell the truth in a way that a label might not want us to, because it would make things seem, you know, maybe less impressive than it would be. Like, if we just tell you, hey, we got to number 3 on all iTunes, the premier destination for not just online music purchasing, all music purchasing. You know, this is it. If you want to buy it, you do it on iTunes. And if we tell you that we got to number 3, that sounds awesome. If we tell you how many tracks or albums we had to sell to get to number 3, unless that number is like 5 billion, something that just goes beyond your sense of what is real or attainable, if I give you an attainable number, and believe you me, if and when we tell you that number, it's going to seem pretty attainable, then it'll seem less important. But we don't really care. In fact, that might benefit our brand as the wry tricksters, because we figured out the glitch in the matrix that we can now trigger.
Well, also, I think that of all the albums we've done, this is the least tricksy of all of it. The trick, I'm using air quotes here, was that we had a really compelling story of why we were doing this album and what's in it and why you, average casual fan of either of our podcasts or Twitter feeds or what have you, should participate in, you know, doing something right this minute, because time matters as much as, you know, it's clearly not about the money. You know, we priced it as low as we can. But I don't know. It felt the less tricksy, the least tricksy. It felt I don't know, like we did a good album.
So I want to kind of break things down. First step is have an audience. And yeah, the size of the audience is not as important as people may think when it comes to the intensity of the audience. And particularly if you notice right now that All's Well, we talked about this before, is listed as an Amazon choice. So it's got this little label at the top that says Amazon choice, which influences people to buy. And it's part of the algorithm. You know, there's an iTunes algorithm. There's an Amazon algorithm. Getting a bunch of people to go buy something is part of it. But then Amazon has seen every particular scam you can imagine for people trying to game the system. You know, they know their entire farms out there of people that will go buy something. You can pay $1,000 and have somebody buy, you know, 500 copies of something all at once. And Amazon tries to adjust for that. They look to see, are these real accounts that we haven't associated with bot farms before? When the reviews come in, Amazon, you know, it got leaked that Amazon was actually looking at people's Facebook connections to see, hey, did this person that just, you know, left a 5-star review, is it one of their best friends? Is it a family member? And so they do a lot of things to try to avoid, you know, the sleazy sort of thing. But, you know, what you guys did wasn't tricky. You have a large audience of fans. You got them excited about a thing you're doing. And then you said, hey, everybody, go buy my thing. It's the same as, you know, what Drake or Kanye does. There's no difference there. Like, hey, let's all go buy it at once. And you priced the strategy right. So there was nothing deceptive about that. You know,
I mean, yeah. the only deception, and it's not even a deception. The only thing tricksy about it is that we very nakedly shouted to the world that we cared about how well this did on day one. A Kanye dare not say that he cares. He just has to, you know, quietly, secretly care, and then, you know, act like it's NBD when it happens, you know, whereas we're like, oh, go ahead.
I don't know. I mean, they do big launch day pushes. It's obvious. It's clear. We're doing a big push. Everybody go out and get it. You know, this is the day that it hits, because the same rules apply to them apply to you. And you know, you want to get those. One, there are several goals you're trying to do. You know, like with books, the first thing I want to do is I want to be able to declare some sort of success. I want to be able to declare success. And one is, you know, outside of the quality of the book and the reviews are super critical, but you want to be able to say, hey, number one techno thriller right now, or top 100 for thrillers. You know, those are things I want to say are top of a category, because that's the proof to other people that, oh, shoot, there's momentum here. It's not just this guy telling about their book. Same for you guys, is you want to be able to get that. You know, if you're an artist, a musical artist, you want to be able to say, hey, top album, top Billboard album, or top 10, mm-hmm. and you push a lot of intensity into a short period of time. Then you want sustainable growth. You want to keep it going. You want the momentum that comes from that. You want what happens when it used to be, well, I want, you know, the people who cover music to talk about the album. I want radio, you know, DJs to play my album, keep going. That now what you're kind of doing is like, I want the algorithm to recognize this has value. And part of what comes through there is you can have a bunch of things get bought. Like, you can scam the system and say, I'm going to have, you know, pay for 500 of my things to get bought and hit number one. But when the algorithm says, yeah, but anybody who bought that afterwards didn't like it, mm-hmm. and you're not going to get recommended or pushed. You got an Amazon's choice because people kept buying it and liking it. And that's a critical part of it.
And sales and chart stuff is still something that, like, the high end of the music industry is still sort of dealing with. There was a thing back in August of 2018 where Nicki Minaj's new album had come out, and when it didn't debut at number one, it had been found out that I think was it Travis Scott had been selling had been bundling album purchases with his merchandise. And so when people bought a shirt or a hat or a hoodie or anything, they would count that as an album sale. And so even in these higher end, you know, high volume sales situations, people are still trying to get people to just even buy albums anymore because people are doing it so less. And it is, you know, if you're a Nicki Minaj and you put out your first album in however many years it was and you can't hit number one because X, Y, or Z, you know, there is a prestige to being able to get that number, especially today, especially when you're very big.
And I hadn't realized how much, just since we did the last album, that the landscape had changed because of streams, right? And them counting or half counting or like, none of us know what alchemy goes on behind the scenes as far as that goes.
Yeah, there are weird things of like an album has to be streamed like 100 times all the way through or something like that to be considered the same weight as one purchase. They consider streams a fractional part, but then there's stuff like YouTube and music videos that feed into different types of charts. There's still radio plays that get factored in there. I wouldn't be surprised if things like Pandora, which are all sort of algorithmically focused, are also a different weight. All of that stuff is very... the little bits of information are very few and far between.
Somebody mentioned the chat room said, I got a CD of the concert ticket purchase. That counts as a sale.
It probably does. Yeah.
100%. One of the things that happens too, is you might hear about a politician or some celebrity just hit number one with a book. Often what will happen is if you want to hire somebody to go speak for you, some, you know, famous person, they might say, oh, well, yeah, the price is $100,000, but we also give you 3,000 books. But those books, they try to count those books as individual. You know, that was a thing, a way of gaming that is, you know, I'll speak for you, but you've got to buy this many books for your institution. It's the way it's played all the way through. Now, as indies, your goal is, one is hitting that number one spot is good. It is very good, and it helps you. The algorithm choose you, and if you have quality, and that's the thing, if the quality is not there, you will get punished. You will see your recommendations fall to the floor. And I've heard people like, oh, well, I had all these recommendations and then it didn't sell. Like, yeah, people didn't like your content. The content sucked. Everybody who bought it after the algorithm, you know, said buy it, oh, we're chortling over something.
I just caught somebody in the chat trying to pull a fast one, and it says, here's Minaj's merch arguments. And then I squinted and I looked at the link and I'm like, that's a link to Andrew Main's book.
Who's trying to pull this shenanigan?
Wrong URL.
Thank you. There was Chris Anderson, I think it was Chris Anderson, wrote a book, The Long Tail, with Wired magazine. And it was a very optimistic view that in the future that, you know, the value for all sorts of things is going to be great. And, you know, there'll be so much money to be mined from content that's 10, 15 years old or older. And I may be totally maligning his argument. I apologize to him for that. The problem was that it didn't account for the fact that you're going to be, even though, yeah, owning these rights to these things, the future may have some value. We're going to be creating so much more content that you're going to be competing with a lot of things. You know, I've watched you talk about the industry changing. 2011 ebooks, I get in a great time to get into ebooks, build up a name for myself. And then every other off person who wanted to write or had skill realized, oh, wow, yeah, I can skip the publisher and I can do my own self-publishing ebooks. So I jumped on board after other people, and I was one of these, guys, I'm ready to show up at this party too. And they're like, okay. And then other people showed up, and then other people showed up. And it changed dramatically. And, you know, I watched, you know, how much money a book can make every month. And then you watch it dramatically drop because there's so much more to choose from. And that becomes its secondary sort of thing. There's how to drive the initial wave. Then there's how do you sustain it? How do you keep moving product?
I don't know. We're really good at day one. I don't know how great we are at day 100. But but then again, I don't know if that, to be honest, I think that there is a larger conversation of where we want the albums to kind of fit in with the Night Attack ideal, because theoretically they would be something that are, they're great resume things. They're great intros to like, oh, okay, well, let's see where we can go, where now we will have a more flowery introduction because we have a number one comedy album, right? But I don't know. I mean, as you know, we haven't really done that in the past. So who knows what we'll do going forward?
You've already articulated to me what it does, how you're doing this, and what works. And this is what we talked about: is you released All's Well. What happened to the other albums?
Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, that was a surreal moment to look at the top 10 in comedy and to see that all five of our albums were fully half of the top 10 in comedy, on either iTunes or Amazon. I think it was iTunes, right?
iTunes. Yeah. Yeah. I think wow. Amazon too, but iTunes was the first one.
So I would say that you got to wag the tail, right? New Andrew, new book. And the wagging the tail comes from, you put something new out. When I had Naturalist come out, and I had, you know, wonderful promotions for my partners, Thomas and Mercer. They did a fantastic job. Book was really well received. I watched all of my other titles skyrocket in sales. Okay. I actually had, you know, other books I'd written, you know, exceeded their advances, and I got payouts from them because of the drive of the Naturalist to this. My own indie books that I had, books that were, you know, 8, 9 years, you know, 6 years old, 7 years old, that had been out there. Sales were incredible because people would get to into this one book and go, oh, I want to read more. And the algorithm would say, I kid you not, I got an Amazon recommendation today let me pull this up. I got to read this to you. Recommendation, Amazon said, hey, here are some other books you might like. Okay. And I get a headline from Amazon: Angel Killer, a Jessica Blackwood novel, and more. Ha! We found some recommendations you might enjoy, and it's all the paperbacks. Angel Killer, Blackfall, Name of the Devil, chronological. This is today. It's because, probably because I pre-ordered one of my own books, and then all of a sudden I get the recommendations for that. So that's the key, is that keep creating. Keep creating. Don't stuff the pipeline with crap and go. And you know, we've all seen this. Justin working at the magic, Brian watching the magic industry, where you make a lot of money off of something like, I'm gonna repeat this thing in 2 months, and I'm not gonna think this thing through. It's gonna be kind of half baked. Then all of a sudden, we've watched people derail their careers as creators because they try to shove too much stuff down the pipeline. The
and
beautiful
might
thing
all
is,
be thinking of the same person.
I don't know.
Actually, yeah. I don't know if we are. Oh, there we go. He's grabbing for the text.
So what I would say is that, you know, that what you guys did is you have other sources of income. You did the album when you had an idea. You didn't rush it. You put it out there. It did really well. People love it. And now the algorithm is saying, oh, yeah, buy this other stuff. Buy this other stuff. And so the long tail got wagged, and now you'll see that. And my advice to other people is, put a thing out there. If it's not a big hit, don't worry. Keep putting stuff out there. I've had indie books that did okay. Then I had another thing came out that did great, and those indie books sold like crazy because people were hungry for more.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it is interesting, like, because you don't want to totally rely on kind of the long tail idea, but there is truth to it. Like, there is truth to the idea that, like, hey, look, we're going to make a bunch of money on these albums that we put out a while ago. And there is an argument to be made that, you know, it was 6 years since we put out an album. We had not put out an album in 6 years, since Night Attack 3. So, like, that was certainly a long time off, but, you know, gosh darn it, if these other albums aren't out there. Oh no, maybe not 6 years. What is it? Maybe 5 years? 5 years. A little less than 5 years.
4 or 5 years, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, fun fact, guess who has the number, speaking of long tails and ancillary markets, who has the number one book on Amazon in all of Italy right now?
What? Really?
Yeah, they did. They just released Il Naturalista. They promoted that.
Oh, so, wow. How cool, Andrew. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I just noticed a big spike because, you know, I study my sales religiously, whatever. It's 4 stars, not the same. It's 4.1 stars, not the 4.2 or 3 that I have in the American version, which,
well,
I
suspect,
you know,
not everything could translate perfectly to the Italian.
Yeah. Don't make you know, listen, if it goes down any further, I'm going to start repeating all the mean things that Andrew Mayne has told me about Italians.
I love Italians. I love Italy. All right. Shut your mouth. I have my, you know, my agency Trident. One of the things they're great about is foreign markets, foreign market rights. And that's one of the things you think about. And, you know, we saw this in Magic, where often selling things overseas is a pain in the butt. But then you realize if you can sell things overseas, turns out the rest of the world is bigger than the United States. Little fact, I kind of didn't realize that. But if you can figure out how to bring to those markets and do that, you know, but also you can look at in podcasting, you know, just even here in the United States, expanding to everybody heard about this here. What's another group of people that are going to hear about this?
Yeah, those were the most successful magicians that would go to on their European tours were the ones that bothered to pay someone to translate their lecture notes, because otherwise, you know, people would you know, just, you know, watch and be like, thanks, bye. Whereas if you had something to sell in their language, that made a big difference.
Yeah. Yep. So audience, any audience, I will say this again and again, start a mailing list. I just did this for my girlfriend because she's got a premiere for one of her short films. And we finally started building her mailing list. I'm like, where do you start? Everybody you've talked to, you know, and she and everybody you've emailed before, we put in the list. Her response rate was fantastic. People are like, oh, great. So glad to see this. You know, start an email list. Even if you're right now thinking, yeah, maybe I want to do a podcast, maybe at some point, start the list now, putting together that and build. Yep. Build.
FloridaManAtExample.com. I never saw that. That's amazing.
But yeah, we Justin, you pushed the button on the Night Attack mailing list for promoting the album. I guess we don't have any way to track those, if there were conversions on those.
I mean, we can track clicks and stuff like that. In general, it is the only way that we know that has stood the test of time in the modern era, that is beyond walled garden. It is beyond, you know, certainly about as far beyond algorithms as you're going to get, right? Depending on the platform that somebody's reading the email on. But, you know, you're able to just connect directly to everybody that signs up. That's, you know, what we thought that the internet would be a lot more like mailing lists, and it didn't turn out like that. It turned out that the gatekeepers had other ideas and more restrictions and varying prices to reach the people on their platforms. But mailing lists, good old fashioned mailing lists, just right.
Hey, I gotta run. But let me just give my pick, if we haven't discussed it already, is where I'm creeping up near the end of the second season of the – there only are two seasons of it. But the closer I get to the end, the more I'm really enjoying Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. If you haven't seen it, it's on Hulu. It first season really makes efforts to be grounded and gets more fantastical in the second season. And it's a bit of a bummer that that there are going to be no more Dirk Gentlys, because I really enjoyed it.
Well, this time around.
Yeah, right? There's always going to be.
Second time.
Yeah.
What's that?
I mean, I assume there'll be a third and a fourth and a fifth. I mean, you know, it's one of those evergreen Douglas Adams ideas that I'm sure will just get remade again and again.
I'm sure at some point, given the popularity of Doctor Who, that they may, like, you know, full on do a lot of some of his scripts and stuff that he did for that.
Oh, wild.
Some of the unpublished ones are ones that they've done. Some, I think it's like radio books or radio plays and stuff, but I could see, like, you know, that'd be kind of a, I don't know. I'm just saying, like, we live in a future. Yeah. Where, like, it's just, you know, content that keeps proving itself every time it comes up to bat has value. And which, by the way, do you know what happened? I think this weekend,
No, I don't know what happened.
What is
you think
the
this
number one highest grossing DC movie of all time now?
Oh, wow. Aquaman.
Oh, yeah? Wow.
Past The Dark Knight.
Crazy.
Wow. How do you feel, gentlemen?
Oh, I'm all in, man. I've been all about Aquaman from the jump, from the first dip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Dark Knight is great, but that was also kind of still a colder time for superhero movies, right? I mean, it was round
yeah,
as a
I think
a
the big difference
film,
here
but...
is China, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
It was domestic, too.
Was it?
I don't know.
I don't know. Do you know, Andrew?
What's that?
Whether this was just domestic numbers or international?
No, international. No. Domestic, it's still behind like Wonder Woman and still behind like Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
And even Suicide Squad domestic hasn't caught up with them yet.
Really?
But this is, what's that?
Really? That's yeah. Crazy that Suicide Squad
shows you exactly how much goodwill DC squandered, to be honest with you. But internationally, I think, yeah, China, look, it's almost made for China. It doesn't involve anything. You know, all the good thing about having all the action happen beneath the waves is that there's no political issues that you're going to have to traverse because no one is really real. So you can all the audiences can cheer and the government doesn't care about it. But it's gigantic. It's visual. And, you know, people punch each other.
294 million in China.
Wow. That's strong. That's strong. Yeah. I mean, that'd still be pretty solid in America.
It is worth a billy.
Wow.
Worldwide.
Yeah. Yeah. When that shows you, it's like, you know, why are Hollywood entertainment, you know, anti-establishment type so willing to, in some cases, like, you know, it's like I'm watching the Pacific Rim or something like this. It's like, I guess the Chinese won, you know. You know, so anyhow, yeah. I digress.
Hey, I got a pick.
All right.
What's your pick?
I watched the Hulu Fire Festival documentary, Fire Fraud.
How'd you like it?
Andrew, have you seen either of these yet?
I watched the Netflix one.
The Netflix one. What did you think?
I enjoyed it. Here is my issue with the Netflix one. And again, I enjoyed it. I recommend it. Is when you get to the end of it and you find McFarlane, you know, he gets to jail and all this. They do a great job. The woman who had the restaurant in the Bahamas, they do a great job of this. You know, because it's this funny, we're laughing. And then you realize, man, these Bahamians got screwed over. You know, these people got screwed over and we're laughing that these influencers are paying all this money to go to this douche event, douche this, and becomes a joke. But then you forget like, hey, and they do a job of illustrating like these people showed up to work on this thing. There's, you've been to the islands. There's often not a lot of opportunities. And, you know, here they get screwed over again. And this woman who thankfully there was the GoFundMe, which is, you know, given her, you know, helped her and the kindness of, you fire fraud fire shows you the worst things of the internet, but then the aftermath of seeing other people go, no, we feel for this woman, the best things of it. My issue with it is we got a minor part of, hey, there was another group of victims there. And the reason he went to jail wasn't because of the people who showed up and were given, you know, bread and cheese. It was because he defrauded $27 million. And that was not really, you're left. It, not that they did this intentionally, whatever, but you could walk away this from the impression that he went to jail because they sold tickets to a thing that was that they had to cancel. He went to jail because there are people who spent millions of dollars helping fund his ventures that got screwed over and got lied to, and we don't do enough to understand who are those people. And some of these, you know, you get some of these people who went, had lawsuits like, I showed up and it sucked and I sued and I got a big judgment. I'm like, good for you. I've gone through worse and got nothing for it, but happy for you. Let's talk about, you know, the Bahamians were the real victims, in my opinion. And then, you know, you're like, oh, well, somebody has millions to spend. Who cares? I'm like, I care. And that's fraud. And so I'd like to have seen more of that.
ICU says that I saw the Hulu one. Not sure if I need or want to watch the Netflix one. I thought that was the best part of the Netflix one because I think the Hulu one skips largely over – at least painting as vivid of a portrait as the Netflix one does of exactly how invested the island of Great Exuma was and how much of a pressure they put on them for like weeks to work, just like everybody on the island working as long as they physically could to get it in the shape that you see it by the end of it. I think that's something that The Hulu one, I think, has – they're both worth it. I very much enjoyed both. They focus on different things, and ultimately I think they both have fairly glaring blind spots that Andrew identified the one that either tackles, which is, I mean, the Hulu one tackles it a little bit more.
They
but
talk about the app and the Comcast like venture capital stuff, which I think was a significant part of his charges, his fraud charges. Is that right? Because he was.
Well, I don't know if Comcast ever invested. I think they pulled out.
They offered a term sheet that the people working at the Fire app thought was a done deal, and then realized later that it was not a done deal. But it's about the venture funds that dude got and how many loans he took out and what he, how he out and out lied. I mean, look, Billy McFarlane is a con artist. And if that's the case, I don't know how the more preachy version of that doc, which is the Hulu one, can justify giving him $250,000 to sit down for that interview. That to me, considering what they wound up getting out of them, it's like that perpetuates yet another or even not to wear it on their sleeves. It's like that's something that came out afterward as opposed to saying like, all right, look, now as we're lecturing the millennial generation of FOMO and how that ties into all of societal's ills from student debt to Trump's election. Let's also point out that we're marks, too, that just dropped $250,000 to have this con artist lie to our cameras for 3 hours in his weird space pants. And by the way, how short is he? Because his heels are massive.
Some of those angles are not super flattering to his height. I do think there is some value. It's one thing to say, you know, okay, this person is a liar. This person told me this and did these things. But I think there is a weird intangible quality to like seeing a person give you a canned lie or a no comment or a dismissal. Like I'm not going to really be talking about that.
Oh, I think it's a better documentary for him being in it. Mm-hmm. However, considering the documentary is leveling judgment at people that, knowing what they knew at the time, maybe should have said something, maybe should have pulled out, maybe should have alerted other people, maybe should have done it louder, to then be telling that story and still giving that guy a like significant amount of money is a little,
there's a scene in the Netflix one where you see a guy briefly identified, Angelo Ruffaro, whatever, who's Chuck Schumer's press secretary, right?
Yeah.
The guy who handles the current press secretary for Chuck Schumer, he's there talking to McFarlane after this thing, after McFarlane's facing federal charges and all this. And you're like, well, what's going on here? Like, why is this guy here? Was he conned here? What's the deal? Because, you know, McFarlane's in the middle of trying to launch and documentaries can be misleading, but like trying to launch, you know, his newest scam on people. And here's a guy, and like, it's like, this is fascinating. Like, cause we don't get into McFarlane's inner sort of circle or how he was able to pull people in, but clearly he's getting people to show up and he's getting people, you know, I have a story at some point I'll talk about, you know, I met through an event years ago, a husband and wife couple, and they're very wealthy, very interesting, very weird about where they made their money. And it turned out the guy was a funneler for Bernie Madoff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just like, and it was years later, because I always kind of checked for this guy's name in the headlines, and it came out he was a guy that was one of the big people who would get, you know, bring in wealthy people to Madoff. And like, that's one of the things you find out with some of these con people is, how did he get $27 million? He knows people, but he also gets introductions. And we saw a little of that beginning where he wants to meet Ja Rule. Oh, I paid this guy $500 and I paid this guy $1,000 and now I get to meet Ja Rule, and it becomes the story of this. But it's like, there's a story of like, was he paying people for introductions to other people? And I mean, there's so much more going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that was an element that was missing from both. And this is, I think, something Andrew and I know have talked about this a lot, about documentaries that at times I'm always wary about documentaries that present that like act like, and here's why this happens. Like, I'm not fully convinced that the Fyre Festival, although the tools in which they used were social media and Instagram, that it's necessarily a parable about millennials. I think that it involved millennials,
right?
But the story here is that a con artist found a soft spot in society where he could promise everybody all the money in the world. So he got the top talent to do the top talent, and he got them so far into the process that governments, vendors, talent, everybody that was going there, nobody had a reason to say, even as it's very clear the emperor has no clothes, and I think a lot of us have been in these situations, you get so far deep into it that you're like, look, I can either keep going and hope that there is just a squirt of money at the end of this that can make my time that I've already justified worth it, or I can walk away now and know for sure that I'm not getting jack because this is bad. That to me is universal. We've seen those situations happen in various different clothing, and I don't, and this is my issue with the Hulu one was, I think it tried to drive that home even further, that this is something that is unique to millennials. This is unique to the social media generation. This is unique to the element of FOMO that has been created by looking at cool people doing cool things on Instagram. And right. I can see where you come to that conclusion. I don't know if I bought it for the justification of all that, nor do by the end of it, did I think it was the most interesting part of the fire debacle. Like Billy McFarland being a con artist is the most interesting part about that whole debacle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. I could see, you know, this being a similar thing with older people and, you know, going to go see the Kentucky Derby and, you know, that we've had versions of this, you know, and did, you know, anybody really know what the Players Club was? Did anybody really know? Did we ever look into this? No, I kid. But yeah, there's, this is our version of it, but it was interesting to see that, like, yeah, wire transfer $250,000 to Kendall Jenner, boom, out goes your thing. And you're, you know, and there was a brilliant strategy there, you know, hiring the top models in the world to go do your photo shoot. And we've talked about, you know, one of the ways that you launch an event is you got to have a big event before the event. If you want to do a big Kickstarter, you need to do a pre-launch before your Kickstarter and not have the first time people hear about it is day one you asking for money.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of parallels to that in other events. It's why they do premiere parties. It's why tell them something's coming. You know, they did this big high profile photo shoot, video shoot where they brought in the top models in the world and then paid them to tweet out Fyre Festival. So everybody who wants to be like them.
Oh, yeah. I think that as a promoter, sure. But the secret to his promotion was, and look, I don't want to take away the fact that once he had all the money in the world, that he didn't do interesting, cool things with all the money in the world. But this was the story of this was how to turn $1 billion into $500,000.
Oh, sure. Right? Sure. I agree. I mean, that's why I said I wanted to see more about the, you know, the people that got the 27 million or so that he defrauded. That was to me is like the, you know, the tragedy of the locals just getting screwed over. And then, you know, the reason he went to jail is, you know, $27 million was given to him. And like, well, how was this done? How do you, not that I want to know precisely how to do it for my own purposes, but.
Yeah. That being said, I think that they are tremendous companion pieces. I liked them both for different reasons. I think that the Hulu one does a better job of giving a bigger overview specifically of the stuff that you're talking about, Andrew, and that going into like, where does this guy get his money? Who is he getting to give his money? Where is he in the hierarchy of venture capitalists? Like, where is he in the hierarchy of New York? How does he find these people? Whereas the Netflix one, which again, it's got its own cardinal sin in that it's everybody that pushed send on all those Instagrams are the people that made the Netflix one. But the video they get and the fact that they, because they worked internally with everybody, they know all the stories. They know the most interesting stories that you're going to tell. And I will repeat, nothing in either documentary is as good as the Netflix one where the one of the business associates talks about trying to go get their water supply from the Bahamian government and what he's willing to do to get it. That's documentary gold if you can get somebody to say that on camera in that plain of language. But it's interesting. I don't know if I quite understood where they wanted to connect those dots in the Hulu version. And it very much left a bad, at least the fact that they weren't self-aware to say, you know, when they have people on camera that are like, Billy will be back. Billy will be back. He'll find a way to get money again. He'll find a way to get money again. You need, if you're going to be that preachy of a documentary, you have to say we gave Billy a $250,000 to sit here. Like, yep. That's how we did it. He did it to you. You're the marks.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, is just that you can't comment on something that you feel either in, pretend that you're a part, it's separate from it when you're part of it, and it was interesting. The Netflix one was, you watched him when he's doing this, the latest scam, like New York VIP access. And he's got a guy in there, you know, dialing. He still has the mailing list, you know, of all these people that have spent money before.
Which, by the way, good reminder, mailing list. So valuable. Yep. So valuable. So
valuable. Yeah, absolutely. And that, because he has a list of these people that were marks before that was spent thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. He gets a guy, they send him, he's like, send him two emails or like, you know, send him an email and then we'll call him twice. They don't pick up first. Everybody picks up the second. And he knows this is a scammer operating. He's like, get him on the phone, tell him he got the tickets. And it's just, you're like, you hear about scammers in jail that figure out, you know, a lot of credit card scams, a lot of these things are run from guys who are doing time for fraud, who are in jail, got free time, got access to a phone, run these things.
Yeah. Fire Fraud, check it out. Really, the only hero in both those documentaries is the same guy that gets interviewed for both that ran the Fire Fraud Twitter account. He is a smug New York finance guy that only in this story comes off as the hero. you get the sense that in the real world, he would be somebody that you'd be like, ah, this guy. But here, amongst these sewer rats and fakers, you're like, finally, a weird finance Batman.
You you get the strong sense that I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that Fire Fraud is not the only something fraud Twitter account that he's opened. Turns out if you open 100 of those and call everything a fraud, one of those are sweet pay dirt.
It's like, I don't know what you do for work, but apparently you just flew down to the Bahamas to prove your Twitter hunch right, and also like he had friends on the Comcast board that right. Could be like, hey, just do me a favor. Don't give this guy money until after the festival happens. Like, he's, I don't know. He was very connected, but yet in this story, he is unquestionably our only child saying the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. And the Netflix one, I'm like, what's the angle here? Like, if you're charting a plane to go, like, there's more here. And I'm distrustful that I don't get more of why you are doing this. And I guess maybe it's more talk about the Hulu, but I mean, that's, it's frustrating, you know?
Yeah. And look, he gives different stories to Hulu. He gives different, like he has different lines of influence there. So I have no idea who he is. I have no idea what he's doing. And it is only in this world in which I'm like, hooray, I'm glad you exist.
Yeah. Watch both of the Fire documentaries.
I would recommend both of them. It is a wild story, and I think that they are divergent enough that you get a fuller picture in watching them.
And I think watch it for that purpose, too, because it's, you know, documentaries I enjoy, and we're in a new age of new documentaries, and, you know, we're getting a lot of them. But when you get two of them on the same topic, it can be helpful because you realize, man, there's a lot of different ways to tell this story. And I'm curious to see their take on it because, you know, you notice they leave out things that you go like, oh, I have a slightly different opinion here watching this other one than I did on the first one. Mm-hmm. So. Cool. We all good?
Yep.
It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.